Welcome to Jaipur Bites, the JLF podcast. I'm your host, Laksh Datta. What you're about to hear is part of the Voices of Faith series for JLF Brave New World, presented by the Kamini and Vindi Banga Family Trust. A History of Christianity, the First 3,000 Years. Dermond McCullough in conversation with William Dalrymple.
Well, Dermond, it's a great pleasure to welcome you to the brave new world of JLF, because you have survived the JLF on the ground and fought your way through our crowds very bravely. For those who don't know Dermot's many extraordinary books, he's a very rare example of an academic at the very peak of his profession who has also very successfully reached out to a more general audience, both on television and in his books. He's won every major historical award, including the Wolfson and the Kundal. He has received honours for, he's a Knight Bachelor of the Realm, which is a very senior chivalric order. He's also a deacon, and so a practising, not a priest, a deacon, and I believe that he refused his to take the priesthood as a protest on the church's attitudes to homosexuality. So he's a brave and remarkable man, but most extraordinary of him, unlike almost all academics, he's willing to take on the big picture. So many historians will guard a small patch and return to it again and again, knowing that it's safely entrenched and palisaded. But Dermot, fearless, has ventured out over 3,000 years of Christianity, which itself, of course, is a characteristically provocative title. So Dermot, I'm going to let you loose on our audience. But first of all, maybe explain why 3,000 years, when most of us would have imagine that Christ or Jesus was born 2,000 years ago.
Wow, William, I'll come to that.
Take your order as you wish, sir. Over to you.
It is a title deliberately meant to provoke and puzzle. So I'm going to approach it by asking first what Christianity is. I've provoked some people by calling it a personality cult, because at the center of Christianity is a person, in history, Jesus. And Jesus is a very ordinary Jewish name. It's Joshua, actually. And onto that name, Christians have put an identity, a title, which is Messiah, the Anointed One, which in Greek is Christos. So Jesus Christ. I mean, Christ sounds like a surname, but as you see, it isn't. It's a title, the Messiah, the Anointed One. So what you've got here is a person with two names, one of which is a title, and that combination makes a very strange and absurd claim. What it's saying is that this Yeshua, this Joshua, from the first century of the Christian era, was also God. It's an extraordinary thing to do, to take a human being in historic time and then say this person is something else, the ultimate being or person beyond being, God. And around that, Christians have told a story. And that's why historians like me are very important to it, because there is a story which we've got to examine, we've got to make clear. At the center of these stories of Christians are stories of how Jesus died. They're called passion narratives, and we've actually got four of them spread across four books which Christians call Gospels. They're at the heart of the Christian message, and these passion narratives, these stories of death, are the earliest bits of Christian literature, very soon after his death, probably. And then Christians, on top of those stories in their sacred book, tell stories about themselves. And that's what you get in my vast book. It's the stories of Christians telling stories about themselves on the basis of that first story. And the story of Jesus Christ is contained in a Bible. So there's a book to start with, but it's a book which isn't a book. Because it's a library of books. Bible is a Greek word. And in Greek, Biblia is actually a plural. It means books. When Anglo-Saxons in England tried to translate the name of this collection, they actually first used a word which has survived in French, bibliothèque. See, library. And straight away, you see that the stories which Christians tell about their origins are already a babble of different voices contained in different books. And this, I think, has been the strength of Christianity, because what it's done is given Christians the power to change and mutate, because there are so many different stories and different versions of the stories at the beginning of the story. All successful major world faiths do this. They can mutate into different forms to suit different human experiences. Christians often don't like being reminded of this character of mutation in their religion, but that's the reality. And it would be better for the mental health of the followers of Jesus Christ if they acknowledged that fact, if they saw the diversity as a virtue and not a vice, an opportunity, not a threat. And already I've used the fact that Jesus was a Jew. He grew up in a different world faith before his followers created a world faith on that foundation. And actually, if you look at the Christian Bible, you'll see the first half of it is simply the Jewish sacred writings, the Hebrew scripture. Jesus himself wrote absolutely nothing that we know about. He left no written works at all. And in fact, as we try and listen to his authentic words inside the stories we have, the Gospels, there's some rather disconcerting things you can say he actually said, and that you can narrow them down to two very certain ones, and they're both a bit odd, because one of them is that he said, "The trumpet shall sound," and the implication being pretty soon. The world is going to come to an end very soon. And the second thing he said was really very shocking. He said, "Let the dead bury their dead." In other words, forget about honourable funeral rites and so on. Let the dead bury their dead. What's that about? It's saying that there won't be a history. There is no point in creating great monuments and gravestones for the dead, because it's all going to end. The trumpet shall sound. Now, the interesting thing about these sort of foundation things that we know Jesus must have said is that his followers very quickly ignored them. Because that's the point of what Christians call the New Testament, the second half of the Christian Bible. They preserved stories about Jesus. They collected their stories. And they survived at the end of the first 100 years of their existence a great crisis of confidence, because the world didn't end. The trumpet didn't sound. And this is one of the most obscure parts of Christian history. It's about 60, 70 years after the death of Jesus, they began to think, he's not coming back straight away after all. And we don't know much about it, because unlike the Jews before them, Christians did not write much about disappointment. If you look at the Jewish scriptures, it's full of disappointed voices saying, "God, what's going on?" But Christians didn't do that. And that's a very important era in Christian history, which one should try and examine, but the sources are very difficult. Well, you asked me, William, about my teasing title, 3,000 years. Now, the point about this is that Christianity is a mutating religion, and that's partly because it has two foundations. There's a sort of built-in instability to Christianity. It's not just the single teachings of Jesus Christ, and perhaps just as well, considering the oddities that I've just pointed out. It has two ancient cultural wellsprings behind it. One of them is the Jewish religion. The other is Greek civilization, culture, thought. twofold foundation, therefore. And the story which you therefore need to tell about Christianity has to reach beyond Jesus Christ for 1,000 years. That's the point, you see. 3,000 years. 1,000 years are the two stories of Greek culture and Hebrew culture side by side, originally not in contact with each other at all, but by the time of Jesus Christ, they are. And so from then on, you have the 2,000 years of Christianity on the top. It was one of those ideas that good ideas that come to you in the bath. I was thinking one morning, how shall I give a subtitle to this huge book? I thought, 3,000 years. And also, you'll note the first 3,000 years, because there is no sign at all that Christianity is going to die out anytime soon. It's expanding. So the first 3,000 years. Let's think about these Greeks and Jews side by side. Both these cultures had something rather strange about them. They thought they were unique and special. Now, you can understand that with Greeks, because think of all the cultural achievements of which the West is so proud. The achievements in art, philosophy, science, Greek drama, the cultural artifacts like the Acropolis in Athens. It's odds on, this is a pretty special sort of people. But what about the Jews? Their history, as revealed in their own sacred scripture, is a real mess. They are constantly being clobbered by the great civilizations of the ancient world, the Assyrians, the Egyptians, you name it. They all put the boot in to ancient Israel. And yet, Israel still went on thinking it was really special. It had a special relationship with a God who increasingly, it said, was the only God. Now, how do you reconcile that? Surely this God, who was really special and had a relationship with these people, would have treated them well? Well, he didn't. He treated them appallingly. Their first great temple to him destroyed, then another temple destroyed. How would they make sense of that? Well, the sense they made of it was that their God was a God of passion. He was all powerful and he was supremely concerned with them. But he was passionate in anger as well as love. When they didn't do the right thing, he would be furious. But then in other moods, he would be merciful and loving. So straight away, what you see about the Jewish God, the God whom Jesus encountered in his childhood, was that he was a really passionate God who changes from anger to love to mercy and so on. Now, go to the Greeks. The Greeks had many gods, but in the end, they began to see behind these many gods, their pantheon, a single divinity. And you see in the works of the great philosopher Plato, Plato talks about divinity. And increasingly, Plato's divinity is a very passionless, perfect divinity. And after all, if something is perfect, it does not change. Perfection presumably implies you've got there. Why would you change from one mood to another? So Plato's God is a God without passion. Now, why is it important to make that distinction between the Jewish God and the Greek God, divinity, call it what you will? Well, because of the Christian claim with which we started. Christians believe that Jesus, this man in first century Judea, was God. And that in itself is an astonishing, almost absurd claim. But straight away, when they made this claim, they were in a world which was both Jewish and Greek. Palestine, Judea had been absorbed in the Roman Empire and before that in Greek culture. And those two cultures were there in the time of Jesus. So when you say, as an early Christian, Jesus is God, well, the next question everyone around you will ask is, well, which God then? Is it the God of our ancestors, the Jews? Or is it the Greek God, the Greek divinity, about which philosophers speak, about which Greeks talk all the time? Because Christianity moved from its Jewish roots into the Greek world. Its sacred writings, its own sacred writings, are in Greek. Not a single trace of the Aramaic which Jesus himself spoke, apart from a few words. And then you look at the history of the church over the next 300 or 400 years, and it's all arguments. And you can understand why. Which God is it? Is it the God of passion? Or is it the God without passion, perfect, which is Jesus? It's not surprising that Christian history is such a mess of arguments right from the start. And it's who Jesus is, what sort of God he is. Well, I could go on, I will a bit, to open up the subject of how diverse Christianity is. If you look at Christianity today around the world, most Christians are either Roman Catholics or Protestants. These are sort of technical labels within Christianity. And together, they're about 80% of all Christians who are alive on the planet today. You can add in an American origin variant on these called the Mormons, and that's 80% or so. And then there's another 10% or so based in the Eastern Mediterranean, in Russia, in origins, and they call themselves Orthodox. And that's usually with some sort of cultural identity attached to it. So you have Russian Orthodox, you have Greek Orthodox, Bulgarian Orthodox, Romanian Orthodox, and you see the pattern. Well, 10% then. So we've got up to around 90%+ of all Christians alive. But that leaves a sliver over. And these Christians were once the future of the church because they were in Asia and Africa. They flourish still in Ethiopia, they flourish in India, and they find an uneasy place in some countries of the Middle East like Egypt, and they hang on for dear life in other places. More often, sadly, they're in exile now from Iran or Iraq, and there you find them in America or Australasia. In other words, it's a sort of lost Christianity which was once the future. And what I did with the book was to make sure that they got their story first, because it was originally the story which looked as if it would be the future. Normally, when Christians tell their history to themselves and everybody else, they start with the Western Church. That's Catholics and Protestants together. Christians who started speaking not Greek, but Latin, who were once really provincial, who were once really unsophisticated on the edge of Christianity. But originally, no, they were the margins, and the story was an Eastern story, an Eastern Mediterranean story. I'll take you to illustrate what happened a bit to a place just beside Istanbul. It's across the water from Istanbul. So it's on the Asian side of the Turkish Strait. And it's a place called Chalcedon. And in the year 451 of the Christian era, a great council of bishops of the Christian church took place in Chalcedon. It had been called by a Roman emperor, or actually by his wife, a lady called Pulcheria, with whom you did not mess. And anyway, Pulcheria got her tame Roman emperor husband to call this council of the church, because there was a burning issue in the church about the natures of Christ. And it was the balance between Jesus the man and Christ the divine Son of God. And Christians passionately disagreed about this. What could be more important, after all, than the identity of Jesus Christ? And the arguments were threatening the empire, not just the church, because now Christians were established in the empire. That's why the emperor was interested. And so the emperor offered the bishops a deal. He looked at the various arguments on either side of the case, and he botched up a deal with some expert bishops. He said, right, that's your deal. Sign up to this or you're out. And so a lot of the bishops did. It was a definition of the natures of Christ between his humanity and his divinity. We Christians, historians, call it a technical name. We call it the Chalcedonian definition of the natures of Christ, the one done at Chalcedon, and Protestants and Catholics together are Chalcedonian Christians, but a lot of the bishops at Chalcedon, who are the people who disagreed on either side of the emperor's compromise, wouldn't accept it. They said, this is a compromise, and it's down the middle of what we believe, and we think that's dishonest. We're not going to accept it. And not only did they not accept the emperor's deal, but they did not accept the views of the other side either. So now, after Chalcedon, the church was irredeemably split three ways between those who signed up to the emperor's deal and those who didn't. And in the Middle East, I found when I traveled around these churches, they have not forgotten Chalcedon. They regard it still as a disaster, a catastrophe, and it split the churches apart forever. In Western Christian history, the Council of Chalcedon has often been seen as a sort of culmination of the story of the early church, rather like you know the detective stories of Agatha Christie with Hercule Poirot. Well, Hercule Poirot gathers all the people in the drawing room at the end of the mystery and tells them who did it. And Chalcedon has been seen like that in Western tellings of the Christian story. But it wasn't. It was a disaster. And it left churches in the East fatally isolated when a new religion, a new monotheism came along, Islam. And actually, those who had not accepted the emperor's solution were quite pleased to see the Islamic invaders. They said, well, the emperor's church in the Byzantine Empire is false anyway, so we'll accept you as our new rulers. And very often, those new rulers thought these Christians in the East were rather useful. Because as a great new Islamic capital was established in Baghdad, it wanted to gather all wisdom under it for the use of Islam. And a lot of this wisdom was Greek philosophy. And now it must be translated into the languages of Asia, particularly the Arabic of the invading conquerors. And who would do that? Well, best Asian Christians who had been arguing in Greek with the emperor's church over Chalcedon for centuries. And they became the think tank of the new Islamic culture of Baghdad. It was, for instance, these Christians who gave the West that brilliant Indian idea of what Westerners call Arabic numerals. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, etc. And the way in which we write them. That was an idea transmuted from India via Baghdad by Christians into first Arabic civilization and then Islamic civilization. And why then did the story change? Well, Islam gradually filled the space. There could have been one way forward for Christians with the Mongols, who some of whom were Christians. But it just tipped the balance. The Mongols decided to back Islam rather than Christianity. And so all the East Asian Christians faded away. There had been bishops in Tibet. There had been monasteries, Christian monasteries in China and perhaps even Korea or even Japan. But now they crumbled into dust and the story became a Western one. Well, William, do you think I should leave it there and perhaps we can...
Let me remind you, this is an Indian festival. So while we're talking about Eastern Christians, maybe what is the historicity of the claims that St. Thomas visited India or at least early Christianity had a presence in either Taxila or in Kerala?
Yeah, I may offend some devout Indian Christians. I don't think St. Thomas, the apostle, came to India. But early Christians did. There is no doubt that by the second century, in other words, about 150 years after the death of Jesus, there were already Christians in India. They're Syrian Christians, and they would come with a strong identity of St. Thomas. And they wanted an apostle as a name, Christians did this wherever they took a new Christianity. They took
it's like a brand name for their...
Exactly. So I don't think Thomas probably did. We know very, very little about him, so it's possible. But what you can say is that when you look at the Christianity of the St. Thomas churches in India, you are looking at a very ancient Christianity indeed, very often with a liturgical language, which is Syriac, and literature, which is Syriac, going to that second century of the Christian era. It's a really continuous story. It makes Indian Christianity very ancient.
Do we know much about the early centuries of Indian Christianity? Are there many documents surviving?
There's quite a bit, actually. And what you see is that Indian Christianity is part of something much, much wider throughout Asia. It's part of what called itself the Church of the East. Now, nasty, snobby Chalcedonian Christians in the West gave condescending names to this church. They named the Church of the East the Nestorians, because one of its early leaders and a very distinguished holy man was a man called Nestorius, who they regarded as a sort of traitor. So Nestorian Christians, not proper Christians. But yes, this is a church which, just like the Christians of China and the Gobi Desert and so on, spoke Syriac, certainly in as they worship God. And of course, they would also speak the languages in which they live, in the places they lived.
And we should note that these churches survive. You go to Kerala today, there is a Church of the East in Kottayam and Trishur and these sort of places.
Indeed. It all got mixed up in the 16th century with the invasions of Western Christians who were Roman Catholics and regarded such Christians as heretical, and very often, often persecuted them and destroyed their books and occasionally burned them, but often forced them to become...
The Treaty of Dampier, is it called? When they have the book burning. In the Treaty of Dampier, I think, when they burn the ancient Christian books of India.
Yeah.
It's amazing. It's very striking that the first persecution Christians receive in India is not from Hindus, it's not from Muslims, it's not from Buddhists or Jains, it's from fellow Christians when they come in the guise of the Portuguese.
It's a sad story, and it is a major theme within Christianity that for the first 300 years or so of its existence, it was not linked with the secular power, the emperor. And then there's a crucial moment, we can date it to the beginning of the 4th century of the Christian era, 314, that sort of period, when an emperor, Constantine, took an alliance with Christianity, and so did other leaders at the time. The monarchy in Armenia did the same thing, the monarchy in Ethiopia. And from then on, you've got a reason for the powerful to impose one sort of Christianity on its subjects or anyone whom it conquers. And that, alas, has been a major part of the story of Western Christianity, particularly Roman Catholic Christianity.
Dermot, I was very interested when you said at the beginning of your talk about you landed on two things that you said were the most authentic sayings of Jesus, or the ones which we know definitely to be said by him. You said, talking about the last trumpet, and you said about let the dead bury the dead. I'd always understood that the sayings of Jesus, represented in the Gospels by the Beatitudes, but also by the early papyri of the sayings of Jesus, which were independent, were the earliest words we had, and that these various little sayings which survive and then went on to survive, surprisingly, in the Islamic tradition of the sayings of Jesus, which when you go to Fatehpur Sikri, south of Delhi, over the main gateway, they have a saying that isn't in the gospel, but which is in the sayings of Jesus, which is, life is like a bridge, cross over it, but do not build your house upon it. Are they not the oldest and most authentic sayings we have?
It is likely that some of them are, yeah. But the reason I've singled out these is that the trumpet shall sound is quoted by the earliest Christian writer, Paul. And so he says, Jesus says, Paul says, has very few quotes from Jesus. He's not really interested in what Jesus said.
And he never knew him, did he?
They met in a vision of Paul's. He's interested only in what Jesus is. And so actually, One of his other quotations of Jesus is to contradict Jesus. Jesus says, no divorce. But I say, actually, in these circumstances, you can divorce. So it's likely that when Jesus said no divorce, this is another of those key core authentic things that Jesus said, because Paul contradicts it. And yet, you know, that Christians have very frequently allowed divorce, and Protestants do at the present day. It's been a constant embarrassment, so much that in one of those four Gospels, in Matthew's Gospel, that saying no divorce is actually modified there. So the writer of Matthew has added, well, except in cases of adultery. So it's a difficult saying, and let the dead bury their dead is one of the most difficult. I think what you get...
Some theologians put up a contrast between Paul's version of Christianity, which in a sense is the mainstream, and an earlier version of Christianity that may have existed with the Church of Jerusalem and may have been associated with St. James. There are also arguments that this is what ended up in India. Would you have any belief of that?
No, I don't really. The Christianity of Jerusalem is very much a Jewish Christianity. There's no doubt about that. And in the authentic letters of Paul, of which some are incorporated in the New Testament, it's clear that there was a clash between the church in Jerusalem and Paul's followers. But the clash is not really about that so much as how far Christianity ought to move out of Judaism. Paul was passionately convinced it must. Many Christians in Jerusalem really thought of themselves simply as the authentic, fulfilled Judaism. And there's a big debate in the early church. But the undoubted winners were the followers of Paul, because the simple fact, which Christians often forget, that their sacred texts in the New Testament are written in Greek, a language which probably Jesus did speak a bit, but more or less the sort of Greek you could order a meal in a Greek restaurant. It's not his natural language, if you see what I mean. He is a carpenter's son who might, you know, haggle in the marketplace in Greek, but his natural language is Aramaic. And yet...
And Aramaic, of course, was spoken as far as India, that some of Ashoka's edicts are in Aramaic in what's now Afghanistan and Pakistan.
Yes, indeed. And yet, in Christian texts, it's simply not there. There are little words embedded in the Greek New Testament, which are clearly important words. Rabuni, for instance, at one point. Jesus is called Rabuni by one of his followers. And the text says, well, of course, that means master. Because you have to tell that to Greeks, because they don't know. But that's the, that is...
Yeah, is that a related word to rabbi?
Yeah, it is. Yeah,
completely.
And so there's this very early turn, which Paul does represent within Christianity, but all surviving Christianity is Pauline, if you see what I mean. I don't think there's any trace of Jewish Christianity. And already in the 3rd and 4th century, Pauline Christians were saying, yeah, there are a few of these Jewish Christians left, but they're a bit on the side. They're not really the real thing.
Very interesting. Looking forward, what do you see as the future of Christianity? Do you think evangelical Christianity, which is making, I know in India, there's huge onroads that evangelicals are making into the traditional Christianities, into Catholicism and into the old St. Thomas Christians, so to speak. Do you see the evangelicals as being the next 3,000 years of Christianity, so to speak?
Well, yes and no. Of course, when you say evangelicals, I have to get sort of technical here, because a lot of this growth is another, actually, 20th century phenomenon called Pentecostalism, which has emphasized the role of the Holy Spirit. You know, the Christians see their God as Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, and the Son, Jesus, the Father, and also this Holy Spirit thing, which is a bit mysterious, but represents energy. And in the 20th century, Pentecostals took up this rather neglected theme within Christianity and made it theirs. There is a growth area. Evangelicalism, yes, clearly very much a growth area. But the thing about these faiths, these versions of Christianity, is that they're very much based on enthusiasm and giving people a new identity. Very often, such forms of Christianity appeal to those who are, feel a bit lost, lost from their culture, adrift in a modern world. And there are comforting certainties in that sort of Christianity. Now, the thing about the constant story of Christianity is people being offered comforting certainties, and then it becomes institutionalized. And all those questions which I raised begin to obtrude, and Christianity becomes nuanced again. And it doesn't have that sharp edge. And then there is another revival movement. Who knows what that will be? And in fact, I would predict that between what you call evangelical revival and Pentecostal revival, there will be a divergence. And the reason for that is that evangelical Christianity is so much based on the text of the Bible, whereas Pentecostalism has this thing about the Holy Spirit, which blows where it wills.
Right.
And these are actually two different sorts of Christianity. They've made an alliance. They sound the same at the moment, but I'm not sure that will last.
Again, looking forward, the next 3,000 years, so to speak, Christianity definitely starts off, obviously, as an Eastern religion, every bit as much as Islam or Buddhism or Hinduism is an Eastern religion.
Yeah.
And by after the rise of Islam and the minimalization of the Eastern Christians in the Middle Ages, Christendom came to be a synonym for Europe, and Christendom Europe was regarded as the home of Christianity, however unhistorical that was, obviously centered on Rome. In the next 3,000 years, where do you think the central weight of Christianity will be? Because faith is dying in Europe. Fewer and fewer people say they believe in God, and fewer people turn up to church. But it's thriving in Latin America. It's thriving in North America. Where would you see the weighting 1,000 years from now? Where would it be centered?
Well, actually, in North America, the thriving has stopped.
Really?
So actually, conservative Protestant evangelicalism in the United States is in steep decline.
I didn't know that.
It's very recent. This is a fact of the last sort of 10 years or so. And I suspect it's something to do with young people's revulsion against the alliance with right-wing politics.
Right.
So there is something, in other words, the USA is looking increasingly a bit more like Europe, a bit more actually like its neighbor in Canada, which does suggest that the energy will come from Africa, Asia, South America. And the big question is really what happens to Pentecostalism. At the moment, again, frequently it's in alliance with right-wing governments, for instance, and right-wing political parties.
And we're thinking here of Trump going across the road and in Washington DC with his Bible on that famous occasion.
Yes, and ironically, of course, he went across the road to an Episcopal church, which represents the most nuanced liberal form of Protestantism you could imagine. Of course, I don't suppose the T man recognised that. So I will not use his name.
One last question before, sadly, we run out of time. We've talked about how the early weighting of Christianity to the East and how India was part of that. How far, I always long to know, how far do you think Christianity was influenced by pre-Christian Eastern ideas? I'm thinking here the way, for example, there were Buddhist monasteries in caves throughout India 300 years before Christ. And then you see that growing very suddenly in early Christianity and far more than many people realize. Eastern Christianity in the early days was the Desert Fathers, it's Egypt, it's men leaving the decaying Roman cities and going to live in the desert, just as the Buddhist monasteries had been. Do you see an influence of Eastern religion? Also Zoroastrianism, the idea of a messiah. Do you see much Eastern influence on Christian ideas in the very first beginnings of Christianity?
Oh, I do. I'm glad you asked me that question, as they say. I think you're probably right that the sort of language of messiahdom and resurrection are borrowed by Christianity. In other words, they can apply existing ideas to the Christian story. But you mentioned monasteries. Now there, I think there is a direct connection, a direct borrowing by Christianity of the idea of monasticism from Buddhism. I think that those...
Is that proven? Can we see any direct evidence of that?
Well, the evidence is there in the shape of the story. I said Indian Christianity is 2nd century. It is Syriac. And the Syrians who were coming to India were traders. That's why they were there in India. And they traded ideas. And they traded the idea of monasticism, which they clearly saw and admired in India. And they took it back to Syria, because it is Syria where monasticism started in Christianity. It is not mentioned in the Bible. There is no picture of monasticism in the Bible. So it has to come from somewhere else.
And so just like you can draw a picture of India being the place which sends Buddhism up into China, which sends Hinduism out into Angkor Wat and right down to Indonesia and Java and way out into Southeast Asia, can you also see Indian ideas of monasticism going westwards and forming the nature of early Christianity?
That's precisely my argument. The first Christians had no monasteries, and then suddenly, by the end of the 2nd century, they had them. And where can that be? It must be India, which I think is a rather satisfying place for us to finish, William.
I absolutely do. It's perfect, David. Thank you so much. Wonderful, wonderful. To be able to do that in such a short period of time, it was an amazing performance. Thank you.
Pleasure.
Thank you for listening to Jaipur Bites. This podcast is produced by Launchora in association with Teamwork Arts. Please subscribe or follow the show wherever you're listening to this to stay updated on new episodes.